From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dalton Conley tells us what he learned about race growing up white in a predominantly African-American and Latino housing project on Manhattan's Lower East Side. He's written a memoir called Honky. He's now a sociologist who directs the Center for Advanced Social Science Research at New York University. Also, writer J.T. Leroy talks about growing up the son of a prostitute who taught him the trade. He was turning tricks by the age of 12. As a teenager, with the encouragement of his therapist, he started writing. Now in his early 20s, he's the author of two books of semi-autobiographical fiction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. U.S. Marines in Afghanistan have reported their first military action since establishing their forward base. A Marine officer says helicopter gunships attacked an armored column near the base. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Marines had been on the ground in Afghanistan less than 24 hours before taking action. A senior defense official says the initial group of about 500 Marines brought armored vehicles and Cobra gunships with them, and they wasted no time in using them. Marine Captain David Romley told reporters at the new base that the Cobras attacked an armored column Monday night in the vicinity of the base. Romley said the attack destroyed some of the 15 vehicles in the convoy. At the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said a key part of the Marine mission in Afghanistan will be to prevent Taliban forces from moving freely around the country. Secretary Rumsfeld said the Marines will be in position to block major north-south and east-west roads in the area. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
UNICEF is warning that as many as 100,000 Afghan children could die if aid doesn't reach them within weeks. Officials say many children could die of hunger, disease, and cold if aid doesn't make it to them within the next several weeks. UNICEF says hundreds of children have already died from disease spreading through refugee camps. Even before the U.S. bombing began, Afghanistan had suffered decades of devastating war and years of drought that had driven millions of people from their homes. The State Department says Secretary of State Colin Powell plans to ask for Turkish and Russian support this week for an expanded U.S. military campaign. Powell begins an 8-day trip to Europe. The State Department also says Powell is likely to work out details of President Bush's planned visit to Russia next year for another meeting with President Vladimir Putin. Reacting to reports over the weekend that human embryos had been successfully cloned by a Massachusetts biotechnology firm, a Republican senator called today for a 6-month ban on such cloning. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas said the kind of human embryo cloning reported by the Massachusetts firm Advanced Cell Technology must stop immediately. Brownback noted that the Senate's Democratic leadership had earlier deferred any debate on such cloning and other bioethical issues until next February or March.
This needs to come up now. With this announcement that's happened by the group out in Massachusetts, it needs to occur at this point in time.
Brownback also called on his Senate colleagues to pass legislation that the House approved 4 months ago that would outlaw human cloning. But Democratic leadership sources say it's unlikely the House bill will be considered before the Senate adjourns next month. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Stock prices rose on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 23 points at 99.82 on volume of 1 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index rose 38 points to finish at 1941. The S&P 500 was up 7. This is NPR News. Attorney General John Ashcroft says he won't release the names of those detained since the September 11th attacks. More than 1,000 people are still being held in the wake of the attacks. Citing privacy issues, Ashcroft says he's concerned that releasing their names might violate their civil liberties. Civil rights groups have criticized Ashcroft's refusal to let the public know who's been picked up. Research director at Amnesty International today said that her organization is shocked that Ashcroft, quote, suddenly declares he has concerns for the rights of people in detention. In Cairo, Arab officials and intellectuals are meeting to discuss ways of improving Islam's image in the West. Sandy Petrukowski reports from Cairo.
Arab officials are taking steps to head off what many see as a clash of civilizations between the Muslim East and the non-Muslim West. Many Arabs are unhappy that after the attacks on New York and Washington, Islam often seems associated with terrorism. Hoping to address these issues, a special 2-day Arab League conference on cultural dialogue opened Monday in Cairo. The goal is to bring Arab officials and prominent Middle Eastern intellectuals together and come up with a plan to deal with what many here see as an anti-Arab backlash around the world. In his opening speech, Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa questioned why racial and religious prejudice against Arabs and Islam is on the rise, and also asked why the Arab world hasn't done a better job of explaining its culture and civilization to the West. For NPR News, I'm Sandy Petrakowski in Cairo.
Philippine troops reportedly used helicopter gunships against Muslim guerrillas in southern Zamboanga today. The troops attacked a large complex held by the guerrillas. Military officials say their troops are battling a group loyal to Nur Mizwari. Mizwari is a former rebel chief who took up arms against the government last week. I'm Frank Stacio.
Support for NPR comes from BookSense, featuring The Seeing Stone by Kevin Crossley Holland, published by Scholastic, at independent bookstores with BookSense or at BookSense.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dalton Conley, has written a new memoir called Honky. It's about growing up white in a predominantly African-American and Latino housing project on Manhattan's Lower East Side, and what that taught him about race and his own whiteness. Now studying race and class is his profession. He's a sociologist who directs the Center for Advanced Social Science Research at New York University, and he's the author of an earlier book called Being Black, Living in the Red, Race, Wealth, and Social Policy in America. Let's start with a short reading from the opening of Dalton Conley's memoir, Honky.
I'm not your typical middle-class white male. I am middle-class, despite the fact that my parents had no money. I am white, but I grew up in an inner-city housing project where most everyone was black or Hispanic. I enjoyed a range of privileges that were denied my neighbors, but that most Americans take for granted. In fact, my childhood was like a social science experiment. Find out what being middle class really means by raising a kid from a so-called good family in a so-called bad neighborhood. Define whiteness by putting a light-skinned kid in the midst of a community of color. If the exception proves the rule, I'm that exception.
Dalton Conley, you say in your book that you didn't realize that as a white person, you were actually in the majority group and that it was African-Americans who had been oppressed. What did it mean to you to be white when you were very young?
Well, very young, initially, it didn't mean anything for me to be white. I had to learn that having lighter skin than the people around me meant something categorical, something different than, say, being taller or shorter or having blue eyes or brown eyes. I had to be taught that by the society and the community around me.
And when you did become aware of race, what did you think separated you as a white person from the African-Americans and Latinos who you went to school with?
Well, at very first, I thought, well, that means I can't really be a part of this group completely as much as I wanted to be. I couldn't be totally accepted. But later on, I learned that, well, there's a consolation prize for my particular situation in that I was belonging to a dominant group in society. I had privileges and power that the people around me didn't have.
What were the privileges and power that you realized you had?
Well, one of the first instances of this privilege or power that I experienced was ironically provided by my local public school, the Board of Education, which we'd like to think is supposed to be one of the more colorblind institutions in society and provide, you know, equal opportunity for all, was the first most memorable lesson of what race means to me, in that in my first class, I was the only white kid in an otherwise African-American class, and not coincidentally, I was the only kid not struck by the teacher. She used corporal punishment on all the other kids with her ruler up at the front of the room. And when my mother came in to investigate why this was occurring, I had started having tics and facial twitches in a very visible manifestation of white guilt. And my mother came in to find out what was going on, and she found out that the other parents had requested corporal punishment and that this African-American teacher had known or thought that white parents, quote, spoil their children, so she would have never dared to cross the racial line and hit me as well.
How much of your identity when you were a child was based on being the white kid in the school?
Oh, it was constant for me. You know, the sense that once I did learn that this whiteness was different than any other physical distinction that marked anyone in our school. It became my identity. I was the white kid. I was the honky in the school. And that wasn't necessarily bad. That meant that, you know, if I acted weird, if I had my facial tics, I sort of had a built-in excuse. Well, I was different. I was the white kid. And, well, maybe all white kids twitched and blinked compulsively. So I didn't feel so personally responsible for all of my own idiosyncrasies. But it definitely dominated my life. That identity dominated my life more than anything else, religion, ethnicity, even class at that point.
One of the points you make in your book, that most white kids growing up in a neighborhood that has a lot of other white kids in it don't really define themselves as being white. They just kind of take that as a given.
Right. I mean, I run into a lot of people who ask me, do whites even have a culture? What does it mean to be white? And in fact, I do an experiment with my sociology students at the university where I ask them on the first day of intro soc to write down 5 characteristics to describe themselves. And I can almost predict to a person that the minorities in the crowd will have put their race at or near the top of the list, but the whites didn't even think of it. They might have put Polish or Italian or some sort of national origin or ethnic identity at the top of the list, but they will never put Caucasian or white or Euro-American. The belonging to this racial category is not something that whites think about, and I think that that's, again, one of the privileges of whiteness, ironically, that we don't have to think about or don't want to think about the power of race in our lives, because if we did acknowledge that being white mattered, that our position of relative comfort and advantage vis-a-vis other groups in society was because of the history of race and belonging to this particular category, we'd have to admit then that there's a causal relationship between that and the relative disadvantage of others. And we rather think that we are where we are in our relative position because of individual characteristics, say skill or hard work or even luck, but not because of these overall social and historical forces.
Were there things that you picked up on from your African-American friends that are considered, you know, black ways of speaking or black dialect or black ways of dressing that you didn't think of as being racially specific one way or another?
For sure. When I eventually started commuting to the white side of town, to the Greenwich Village of Manhattan, to a rich school, and I had to learn a whole new way of interacting with people there because, for example, in my neighborhood, you didn't look someone in the eye for a long time. You didn't hold eye contact because that was considered confrontational. And you had to show respect and deference to people around you, and that was the norm. Meanwhile, on the other side of town, if I didn't look someone in the eye and hold eye contact when I was talking to them, that was considered rude. And I had to learn that, oh, I'm over here, I'm supposed to do it this way differently than I did back at home.
What about the way you spoke and the way you dressed? The music you listened to?
Yeah, I quickly learned to put on a different face, whether I was over on the west side of town or back in my neighborhood. But eventually, I think it all melded into one. I toned down my snapping on the west side of town, and I retreated increasingly from the community back at home. In terms of dress, everything I wore was a hand-me-down from a kid up in Pennsylvania who lived next door to my grandmother, whose name was Jeff Fry, and so I had not much choice in my clothing. In fact, everything I wore had the label Jeff Fry sewn into it. So my mother used to joke that if they ever found me after an accident, they'd call the wrong family, Jeff Fry was like a new designer label to me. So I wore standard Sears clothing, and that sort of didn't help me fit in back in my neighborhood and didn't help me fit in among the rich kids of the Greenwich Village either. In terms of music, again, I was sort of a nerd, which is a dominant identity, and that meant that most of the music I listened to happened to be coming to me from other people's radios. And back then, boombox radios had taken over the public space back in my neighborhood, and there was disco flowing out and R&B and soul at all hours, really loudly, so much that it would float up to the 21st floor where we lived at the very top floor of our building. And I could hear Anita Ward's Ring My Bell continuously for what seemed like 6 months to a year over and over again. And then I could go to the Greenwich Village and I didn't hear music at all on that side of town. It was much more quiet.
My guest is Dalton Conley. His memoir is called Honky. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dalton Conley, and he's written a memoir called Honky about growing up in a neighborhood that was predominantly African-American and Latino, and he was one of the few white kids there. Conley is also a sociologist. He teaches at NYU, and he writes about race and class as a sociologist as well. Why did your parents move to a housing project in Manhattan in 1968, a housing project where, as a white family, they were going to be very much in the minority? And 1968, the year they moved, was a year before you were born.
Mm-hmm. Now, most people, when they hear that, oh, you grew up in the inner city and amongst all these housing projects, your parents must have been political. They must have been communist or labor organizers or housing activists, and they moved there out of a political agenda. Nothing could have been farther than from the truth. They thought, actually, it was a quite almost suburban environment. They had been trying to make it as an artist and a writer, respectively. My dad is a painter and my mother as a novelist. And they were living in a kind of walk-up tenement apartment about a half a mile from where we ended up living. And they had been robbed so many times that they had their television chained to the radiator. And one time they came in and they caught the guy red-handed. The police came and arrested him. And as he was being carted off to jail, he claimed that he was going to come back and kill them in revenge. Now, whether or not that was true or not, my mother took that seriously and said, we got to move, and we got to move now. So they claim that this opportunity to move into the subsidized housing unit was the best opportunity at that time. My father actually resisted it because he thought it was too bourgeois, too suburban-like, and not bohemian enough for him because of the sort of standard cookie-cutter-like apartments. He thought it was the urban equivalent of Levittown. And he relented, though, and agreed to my mom that they had to move, and there we were. Now, as an adult sociologist, I know a different story, that they had a lot of choices. I think my mother liked to think she had no choice because it helped her guilt for having raised her kids in a very high-risk neighborhood with lots of violence and drugs, etc. But I think she did have a lot of choices back in 1968, and that distinguished us from our neighbors around us. And even from before I was born, my life was different in that my parents could have moved to, say, a white working-class neighborhood in the outer boroughs, which my neighbors, because of racial antagonism, couldn't have. They could have moved back to Carbondale, Pennsylvania, where my mother grew up, and lived with her parents, who were solidly middle-class, and given up the idea of being in New York to be a writer and an artist. But they didn't do that either. Most of the people around us were already living with their grandmother. They could have gotten a job, made more efforts to get a full-time regular job, which they might have had some struggles, but they certainly would have had an easier time than the people around us. So even before I was born, my situation was quite different than the people around me.
How did your parents feel, do you think, about bringing up their children, you and your sister, in a neighborhood that was becoming increasingly unsafe? You know, there's a family nearby that was murdered when you were in junior high school. Your good friend was shot in the neck and paralyzed. Because it was such a tough neighborhood, you studied karate, and your karate teacher was shot and killed. So, you know, it wasn't a safe place.
No, not at all. And my mother's worries about safety approached almost a feverish pitch. She had all these computer-like algorithms that she programmed into my sister and my head in order to prevent us from having something terrible happen. For example, we had specific instructions of how to answer the steel door to our apartment. She sewed money into my clothes or put it under the inner sole of my shoes, $5 bills, so that It was called mugging money, and I was supposed to never argue with anybody who mugged me and just hand them the money. She'd read too many New York Post headlines about teenager killed for $2, so that had I been walking down the street in the 1970s or 80s, and had you run into me then and asked for $5, I would have just handed it to you. I was so programmed to just give money to anyone who demanded it from me, until I caught on, of course, and then spent it myself on comic books and candy and video games. But she went through all these creative extents to try to regulate our safety. She made us sign contracts so we would have a free trip to the 99-cent store, one of those discount stores where she said price was no object, and she would let us pick up anything at the 99-cent store if we signed a contract saying we wouldn't, for example, lean over the edge of the subway platform or ride on the backs of buses, as was a local sport to grab onto the back of a bus and surf it, so to speak. So she went through lots of efforts to try to ensure our safety in an increasingly unsafe neighborhood.
What about you when you were growing up? Were you afraid a lot of the time? Were you strong? Could you hold your own if somebody picked a fight with you?
I was definitely a nerve of the neighborhood, but I developed a certain savvy given that to sort of avoid situations that would have gotten me in trouble. Didn't always work, but I was afraid a lot of the times. I used to do the laundry in the basement, and there were people lurking in the basement, and not just... I wasn't just imagining it. I would run up to the first floor and wait for the elevator in the ground floor. If I saw somebody on the elevator that I didn't like the look of, I would just pretend it was going the wrong direction and wait. If I had to walk up the stairs, the windowless stairs of the 21 flights, I was just terrified, especially since on a lot of flights, the lights were out and I'd have to traverse in pure darkness. So the fear level would rise and fall. I had always thought that I was safe in my apartment behind the steel door, but then one time when we were out, someone tied the fire hose on the roof to the railing and swung into the open window in our kitchen and robbed us. That totally shattered my sense of our apartment as a fortress or a security blanket. And we closed the window and locked it and thought, well, that will solve that. And later on, when we were gone again, he crashed through the window and left a little bit of a bloody trail and robbed us again. So for a long time, that really made me feel like I had no security whatsoever. We eventually had to have bars installed in the window because we didn't know what else to do. So that was becoming a metaphor for my increasing estrangement from my local community, in that we lived 21 flights off the ground yet had to have bars on our window.
No, you eventually transferred to a school in Greenwich Village, a school that I think you described it as a wealthier school before.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a pretty middle-class school or upper-class school?
Well, it ranged from middle-class to upper-class. That was one of the most shocking distinctions to me when I got there was in my old school in the local neighborhood, PS4, everyone was more or less of the same economic status. You know, some people were on welfare, some people were on food stamps, some people had parents that were working full-time, some people didn't, but more or less you were working class or poor. Over on the west side of town, there was a whole range of class statuses that I had no idea even existed. And it was very shocking to me that in the initial days I was there that, for example, some of the kids were, the nerdiest kids were the most popular kids. I didn't get what was going on. It had been like I entered a Twilight Zone or an alternate universe. Back at my school in my neighborhood, you were popular if you brought something to the table or to the playground, if you were a good snapper and really humorous, or if you were fast, or if you were big and strong. It was about your individual characteristics. Over there on the west side of town, where the range was from middle class on up, I noticed that, oh, it doesn't matter if you're a nerd, or if you can't snap, or if you're not particularly good in sports, it matters what your parents do or how rich you are. Only by spending time in kids' apartments or houses after school did I realize where the hierarchy within school, the popularity pecking order, came from. One kid had an entire lower level to his brownstone that was his, that was a rec room, and had an entire closet of cans of Coca-Cola. Now, he was the most popular kid in school, no matter what other characteristics he had. So there was a whole language of class that I was learning on the west side of town.
How did your identity finally change when you went from being like virtually the only white kid to being one of many.
I think that was a tough transition in that I had relied on my whiteness as an excuse for a lot of things. If I wasn't good at sports, or if I wasn't particularly good at snapping, or if I wasn't as cool as the kids around me, it was because I was white. I could rely on this sort of group identity to excuse my own behavior. But when I moved to the west side of town and realized that I wasn't fitting in there either, I couldn't rationalize to myself anymore that it was because of my skin color, because of race. I had to accept that, well, maybe it's because of me. There's something unique about me that made me not quite fit in anywhere. And that was quite a shock to me.
What'd you make of that?
Like any teenage kid, I first just developed defense mechanisms saying I hated these kids over on the west side of town, and I wanted to be back with my people down the Lower East Side, and they're not cool. They don't know how to snap and diss. They don't know how to do this. And, of course, now I realize that that was defensiveness and feeling put upon myself. And looking back, I still think that it was partly because of race and class that I was feeling such an outsider on both sides of the fence. Because I, unlike kids who lived their lives on one side of the invisible line that divided Manhattan, I had to cross lines and therefore didn't feel integrated into either community. For example, I brought home a kid one day from my rich school back home, and I was so embarrassed of him because he had long, straight, blonde hair. He walked bouncing up and down in a totally untough way. He wore sandals. He was a hippie kid, and I was afraid they were going to think we were gay. And I was simultaneously afraid that he was going to think, what kind of pigsty does Dalton live in? Because there was needles lying on the ground, there was broken glass everywhere, there was graffiti and garbage pouring out everywhere. I tried to shuffle him straight from the school bus into my building, and he got distracted by a pile of electronics parts and said, wow, we can build in a crystal radio, we can do anything. And all the other kids crowded around saying, oh, can you build a laser? Can you build this? Can you build that? And he was totally unselfconscious and fit in, even though I thought that they would have beat the hell out of him and not accept him. And it was my own self-consciousness that had prevented me largely from fitting in anywhere.
Well, Dalton Conley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Dalton Conley is the author of the memoir Honky. He directs the Center for Advanced Social Science Research at New York University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, growing up the son of a truck stop prostitute, we meet J.T. Leroy, a 21-year-old writer who is already the author of a novel and a collection of short stories based on his experiences. His novel, Sarah, is being adapted into a film by Gus Van Sant. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, J.T. Leroy, is a 21-year-old writer with two books of fiction based on his experiences as the son of a truck stop prostitute. His mother was 14 when he was born. He spent the first few years of his life with foster parents. They tried to adopt him, but his mother sued to get him back when she was 18 and won. When Leroy was 15, his therapist at a hospital adolescent psychiatric unit, Dr. Terry Owens, encouraged him to write. Leroy's books can be described as transgressive fiction, filled with the kind of emotional and physical violence and sexual extremes that he's been exposed to. In fact, some of the content of our interview may not be appropriate for children. Leroy's books have been praised by writers like Dennis Cooper and Mary Gaitskill. His novel Sarah is being adapted into a film by director Gus Van Sant. His latest book is a collection of short stories called The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things. Although Leroy is forthcoming about his life, he doesn't like to show his face to the press. He's photographed with masks or disguises and does most of his interviews by phone. Leroy says his early life with his foster parents was very middle class with lots of toys. Things changed when his mother took him back.
What she took me away to was a life where I really don't think she understood what having a child was at all. It was more something to have. It was like you might as well have a new bag or something, and it wasn't what she at all expected. And it was poverty. You know, she didn't have money. She didn't have a support system, and she wasn't trained in any way. She didn't know what to expect, and she never wanted to have a baby to begin with. She was denied being able to have an abortion. And she tried to have one, but they sent her away to have a baby and then offered her no support after.
Was she still working as a prostitute when she took you back?
No. When she took me back, she hadn't yet really entered into that at all. She was doing a little bit of dancing and things like that, but she, at that point, she wasn't. She was trying to work, being a waitress, and it was horrible. She wasn't making enough money to feed herself and feed a kid or any of that.
So she ended up actually working as a prostitute, working mostly with truck drivers, I think.
Yeah. You know, when we drive off and you pull into truck stops and there'd be girls just pulling down so much money just for climbing in a car with a guy, it just seemed like a real easy way to do it. And she was already dating, she was doing that with truckers, but it wasn't like official. You know, she wouldn't do, you know, she wasn't thinking of it as being a prostitute. And then she did more.
Where were you when she turned tricks? And who would be taking care of you while she was out?
Well, there's a lot of women who work in truck stops, and very often their kids are just there. You know, we'd hang out in somebody's car, one of the people's cars, you know, or somebody had a hotel, or in the diner. You know, you'll see a lot of kids just hanging out in back rooms and diners, you know. So it's not like anybody really watched us. We just kind of, you know, there's lots of stuff to get into at a truck stop.
So you had friends who also had mothers who were prostitutes at truck stops?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like a whole little subculture, a whole little world.
Yeah, it is, and not that many people are kind of aware that it exists.
So did that world start to seem normal to you?
Well, very much so. I mean, I pretty much packed away the memories of my family, and it just became my present reality.
Did you end up having to do tricks yourself, having to turn tricks yourself?
I didn't have to, but I wanted to. I just saw that there was so much money to be made, you know, that I really admired how they looked and the attention they got and having that money and stuff like that. And I think that, by then I'd already had sex with older men. And I think that there's a way that when you're young, if you've had sex already, it doesn't have any special thing to it or any sacred thing to it. it just becomes something you can trade.
Is this sex that you had because somebody was forcing themselves on you or because you wanted to have it?
Well, originally it was forced, but it became something that I couldn't really tell the difference between what I wanted and what was offered, you know.
You said you'd seen, like, the adults around you turning tricks, and they made money, and you liked the way they looked, so you wanted to do it, too. Were you also exposed to the other side of it, the dangerous side, the abusive side, the really kind of depressing and dangerous side?
Well, I saw my mom hooking up with the guys that used to be abusive. She was very attracted to that kind of personality, and if they were too nice, she wouldn't stick around with them much long.
Did she know that you were starting to work yourself?
Yeah.
What was her reaction to that?
Oh, I think there was kind of competition there. And
so she felt competitive with you instead of protective or angry?
No, my mom didn't feel... I mean, she felt angry about the competition, but she also liked the money, too. So it wasn't like a normal parent-child relationship. I don't think she really viewed me as, like, her child. I mean, I wasn't supposed to speak about her being my mother. You know, it was... that's why in the book, it's like I accuse her of being my mother, and everybody kind of freaks out, you know, and Sarah.
Why didn't she want people to know that you were her son?
Well, because she felt that men felt competitive, you know, and that also it made her seem older and made her seem worn out and that her parts was worn out, and it just wasn't sexy to be a mother. But if you're an older sister, that's much better.
So you were passed off as her younger brother?
Usually younger sister.
Why did she pass you off as her younger sister?
Because it was less competitive to men to be having a boy around. And also, if we were two pretty girls out, we were more likely to get free things.
How old were you when she started passing you off as her younger sister?
Like about 5 or 6. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, I wasn't quite... I knew what the difference between a boy and a girl was, but I liked wearing... I liked being somebody else, being dressed in pretty things, and I liked the attention. I liked how she was towards me.
Must have been pretty confusing, though.
It was confusing trying to figure out who I was at any different time. Like, if we'd go somewhere new. If we went somewhere new, I'd have to figure out or try to remember, like, what my name was, what sex was going to be, what her name was going to be, what our relationship was going to be. Because sometimes she'd tell me, and sometimes she believed in ESP, and that we used to practice ESP, and that I should be able to receive. She was the sender, and I was the receiver, and I should, you know, if I was listening good, I'd be able to receive the thoughts.
What kind of terms are you on with your mother now?
She's not around, so...
Do you mean you don't know where she is or that she's passed away?
Yeah, the second one.
Uh-huh. Were you close to her when she died?
No. She took off. She used to take off a lot. And she took off. I followed her a couple of times, you know, once I got into therapy when I was working with my therapist, but I followed her to Kansas City, and I followed her to somewhere else where she went. I can't remember where it was. But it wasn't good. And she had hepatitis, and she wasn't dealing with it. She had abscesses, and she wasn't taking care of herself. And I feel like if I had been there, I could have made a difference.
So you cared enough about her to have wanted to save her.
I think about it all the time.
My guest is writer J.T. LeRoy, author of the novel Sarah, and the new collection of short stories, The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer J.T. Leroy. His fiction is based on his experiences growing up the son of a truck stop prostitute. Before we talk about how you started to write, I'm wondering if you read much as a boy, if there were any books around.
Oh, yeah, I read all the time. When I lived with my grandparents, when my mother would lose custody of me, I would be sent back to my grandparents in West Virginia. And there we read, you know, the Bible, and I actually had to write a lot. I'd write scenes, you know, like take a character from the Bible, you know, like Joseph meets Moses, you know, write a scene, you know, that kind of thing. And I'd get in trouble for being too creative, you know. So I was educated pretty well with books. I guess there's this perception sometimes I've read about, like, Barefoot, West Virginia, you know, and it wasn't like that. When I was with my mom, we'd drive around in a car, but I used to steal books a lot. Sometimes I'd take them from libraries. I just always had to have books with me.
Did you go to school?
I did here and there. You know, sometimes when I'd be in placement, I'd go to school, and there were periods where my mom would try to be legitimate. She'd meet some guy. It usually didn't last very long, and usually I was placed in special ed because I didn't test very well, and I just don't test. I wouldn't take the test. You know, I just couldn't do it. And I preferred those classes because then they just leave you alone and you could read, you know.
You know, you mentioned that your grandparents would have you read the Bible and also write imaginary scenes based on biblical figures. It must have been confusing to go from your mother's life of prostitution to your grandparents' life of Bible reading.
Yeah. It was like going from hot to cold to hot to cold because she'd come and get me, and I would go back with her. And it made me pretty crazy. It was hard to shut off one for the other because when I'd be with her, I'd be judging it through the lens of sin and hell, because I was street preaching too, and if she heard any of that from me, it was not a good thing. So I had to be careful. And then I'd be with her, and I'd have words coming out of my mouth and speak a different kind of language that if when I went back with my grandparents, if I was speaking that way, it was not a good thing. So I just had to cut parts off.
How did you start to write?
When I was with my mom, I used to have notebooks, and once I was writing stuff because I just felt like I was filming everything. I used to watch a lot of movies, too, and I'd spend some days, you know, where you go into, like, a Cineplex, and I would just go from movie to movie and spend all day and all night there. I just really liked the feeling. It made me feel less lonely that I was narrating, like, a film or something. And I used to start to write it, but she once read it, and it was not a good thing. So then what I did is I got a notebook, and I would just write one word on each page, and then I could fill the rest in my head and know what it said. Like, I could go back and read it like it was a book, and she couldn't read it or say anything about it because there was just one word on each page. And I did that for a while, but then I just stopped doing it when I got more kind of like out on the street as I got older. And the way I started writing again was my therapist started asking me to write because he felt I had a problem with continuity between sessions.
What do you mean continuity between sessions?
I had a therapist, and he felt I had problems with continuity between our sessions, which means holding on to, I guess, a sense of any of the work we were doing between each session, which was every day. And he kept asking me to write, that he wanted me to write, and I didn't want to write. And he was asking me to write for probably about a year before I started. And then he teaches at the University of San Francisco, and, you know, he teaching these social workers that wanted to be therapists, that wanted to be social workers, and he knew how bad I hated them. And that here was an opportunity for me to teach them, to tell them what the real deal was. And I liked that idea. And so he asked me if I wanted to write something for his class, so I did. And it was like feeling the switch go on. I got the feedback from them, and it just, it was like feedback not based on how I looked or having sex with somebody and how I performed or didn't perform or whatever, you know, or it wasn't any of that. It was just from something else. And it was like this craving turned on me. And all I wanted to do was keep doing that. And drugs interfered with my ability to write. So I stopped doing drugs because I wanted to write. And it just started taking over.
So you started writing stories because your therapist asked you to write stories about your life so that he could show that to his students who were social work students, and they could learn more about you and other young people like you. How did you actually get published?
Well, I just want to say, I think that his goal was more to get me to write.
And the other was just to kind of ploy.
Yeah.
How do you think he guessed that you could write?
Well, I've asked him, and he didn't know that I could write. I mean, he said that my language, like the way I always speak in metaphors. Matter of fact, when I was on the street, a lot of the other kids that was on the street would give me a hard time about using metaphors all the time. Whenever I would, very often when I say things, I see it and as an image, and I really want to be understood. So this image just comes up, and I would have to say it's like this, and then I give a metaphor, and they would just think that was the most retarded thing in the world, and they would really laugh at me when I would do that kind of stuff. And I think Terry recognized that in my language. But he really wanted me to write in order to have to be more inside myself and more reflective of what was our work, and that it was a tool to keep, because I couldn't retain anything he said. I mean, it was like pushing a boulder up the hill, and I would go off from seeing him and go get high and just do tricks and just self-destruct and do very self-destructive behaviors and often end up in a hospital, you know, from doing something that hurt me. And he wanted me more he thought writing would be a way to be reflective and stay more inside myself instead of just running.
How did you first get published?
My work got passed from writer to writer, and before I knew it, I had a book deal and an agent before I even had a place to live. I never once sent out anything. I never asked anyone to send it to their agent or to, you know, I didn't even know how all that worked.
Once you started meeting from or hearing from published writers, Were there things that they suggested to you about your writing that were revelations to you, things you'd never thought about before that were really helpful?
Yeah, well, I really craved to get better. I mean, my therapist asked me if his upstairs neighbor was an editor, and he asked me if I was interested in hearing what he thought. And the thing is, because I was always asking Terry, well, what do you think? How could I get it better? You know, how could it be better? You know, my therapist, I wanted to be better. I would read authors, and I knew I wasn't where I wanted to be, and I could feel the limitations of my brain, like hitting up against a metal ceiling, you know. It was painful, and I so wanted to expand beyond that, and didn't even have the drill to do it. And he passed my work to his upstairs neighbor, and his upstairs neighbor gave me my first feedback, and it meant everything to me to start to learn. There was a poet that Trick had turned me on to. he had turned me on to a lot of writers, and Sharon Olds was this poet, and it was the first poet I could ever read. I hated poetry, couldn't understand it, and she was someone I could read and be moved by and cry and just feel, which really surprised me. And he had studied with her and was friends with her and said, well, why don't you write to her? And I was like, uh-uh, no way. And he said, I contacted her and she wants you to write her. And I did. And I just, he said, just tell her what you feel. And I did. I just wrote and told her what I thought. And she wrote me back. And we started writing to each other. And it was amazing. And that was when I was 15 when we started writing. And it was like the idea that you could write to a writer and they'll write you back was like the idea that you could write to God and they'll answer you, you know, or something like that. It just was surreal to me. And also that I wanted to know what they knew, and I was in awe of people who had that power of having a voice and expressing it so beautifully. It's like being a superhero.
My guest is writer J.T. Leroy, author of the novel Sarah and the new collection of short stories, The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer J.T. Leroy. His fiction is based on his experiences growing up the son of a truck stop prostitute. Although your work is really catching on, you don't make public appearances. You'll do interviews about your writing on the telephone like we're doing now, where no one can see you, not even the interviewer, but you won't show up in person. When it comes to readings from your work, you'll ask friends who are writers to show up and read on your behalf so that you don't have to go to your own readings. Some people even think that you might not really exist. In other words, that J.T. Leroy might be a pen name or a hoax or some kind of extended performance piece. I've even considered that possibility myself. I mean, do you run into this a lot, that people think that this is just some kind of hoax?
Yeah, and I definitely enjoy it. It's something that I can't say I discourage. The whole thing about the reading started very organically. I actually did a reading. I was in this book called Close to the Bone, an anthology by Laurie Stone, and they wanted me to do a reading, and I had never done one before. And I got up and I took enough drugs where I thought I could do it, but the words were blurry, and my hands were shaking so hard, the blurry words were bouncing off the page like worms, and I just vomited. And they thought it was performance art, and they applauded. And I think it's funny now, but at the time it was mortifying, and I swear to God I'd never, ever do that again. And that I don't have to make myself available, that, you know, I wrote out of irritation. And I don't mean to compare it to a pearl, but it's like the way the oyster produces the pearl out of irritation. I wrote out of irritation. And I write to produce myself oxygen. It allows me to live. And writing helped me get off drugs and helped me stay off drugs. It helped me function. When I get in trouble when I'm not writing. And the fact that it's reached an audience is amazing, but was not the purpose or the intent.
So why do you still feel it's so important to keep your identity hidden. I mean, at least to keep your physical identity hidden.
Well, the thing is, I'm doing more press and more stuff than I've ever done before. You know, I've done photo shoots. You know, I did one for Vanity Fair and a bunch of different magazines. I'm on the cover of one of the biggest German magazines.
So. Yeah, but most of the photo shoots, you're wearing a mask. I should point that out.
Well, sunglasses are a mask. Yeah. You know, the thing is, it's like I'm not writing about our friend the mushroom or rocket science and how it affects our friend the world. You know, I'm writing about pretty personal stuff. And to be out on the street and have people come up to me and know that stuff. Also, the gender issues. I really never want someone to come up to me and say, I know what you really are, and be in that position where they could hurt me until I figure out what side of the fence I'm going to be on.
In terms of gender?
Yeah. And sometimes I like to go out as a girl. Sometimes I like to go out as a boy. And I really don't want that to be an issue for anybody else except myself.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I'm really, really honored, and I appreciate it.
J.T. LeRoy is the author of the novel Sarah and the new collection of short stories, The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things. His novel Sarah is being adapted into a film by Gus Van Sant. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song by the band Garbage that's dedicated to J.T. LeRoy.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Fiery Cross, a novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of The Outlander Saga. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the mogul of hip-hop culture, Russell Simmons, co-founder of Def Jam Records. He has a new memoir called Life and Death, Sex, Drugs, Money, and God. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.